My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be. To be.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the Reproductive Rights Amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.
This episode of Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you would like to learn how to support this podcast, visit www.patreon.com/writingexcuses.
Season 19, Episode 43. This is Writing Excuses.
A close reading on structure, parallelism, and inversion.
15 minutes long because you're in a hurry.
And we're not that smart.
I'm Dong Lun.
I'm Aaron.
And I'm Howard.
So this week, I really wanted to talk about the parallel structures that are present in Fifth Season. We talked a lot last week about perspective and POV and how those shifts, and we got a little bit into parallels just inherently in that. But the way Fifth Season is structured has two major structural things, in my view. One is you have the three POVs of Demaya, Cyanite, and Esun that all have their own arcs, right? They all have the arc of being pulled through the story in a beginning, middle, end way. There is also an inflection point somewhere in the book where you have this mirroring structure of beginning with a child death and ending with a child death, right? We have Esun / Cyanite losing both of her children, or two of her children, and the inversion of her husband killing her son, and then her killing her own son at the end of Cyanide's story, is this absolutely devastating mirroring effect as we have the inversion across the book. And that works because we have these three parallel structures. So I just kind of want to toss it to the group a little bit. Like, is that something you clocked in the moment of the sort of rhyming between the different narratives, or did they feel really distinct to you?
I did notice that there were parallels. I mean, I've only read it once. You have the advantage of a second and perhaps fifth read on me.
I think three total now, but yeah.
I've only read it once. And so, a lot of my time was spent figuring out, you know, what's going on. But by the end, I definitely noticed the parallelism of the three POVs. The other thing that I noticed, and it took me a while to really grasp the in-world terminology of Fifth Season. Mm-hmm. The Fifth Season is not, there have been four seasons and now there is a fifth. A Fifth Season is a season in which a catastrophe adds a season to your year. Mm-hmm. And it,
or
may,
your 10 years, or whatever.
Yeah, it adds a season to this year, and that season may span multiple years or decades. And there was a parallelism to that because they kept coming back to previous, you know, talking about previous fifth seasons, mm-hmm. the choking season, the season of teeth, acid season. The idea that there was a season in which they learned metal just doesn't last well because we get acid rain and it will destroy those nice things you've made.
This goes back to secondary world contextual tension that we were talking about, you know, many episodes ago now. But it's such a wonderful idea of seeing the in-world understanding of the context of a thing where Cyanite will look at the metal doors of a rich, what's the term for the towns?
Eumenes?
Oh, no. There's like the holds, like the towns with
Homs?
comms, thank you, where she would look at the big metal doors on one of the comms and just be like, these damn fools have no idea what they're doing because of the contextual sort of history there. But yeah.
Well, and coming back to the parallelism, there was this idea, and I didn't get this until 80% of the way through the book, the idea that Demaya Cyanite Essen's life is itself punctuated in the same way the world's life is punctuated by fifth seasons. There are these periods of disaster, these periods of upheaval, and I loved that.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say, for me, it felt more cyclical than parallel.
Mm-hmm.
I think I felt more like, you know, life changes, but does it change?
Yeah.
And I think the fact that it's called the fifth season sets me up contextually. If you think about it, the title is the most obvious piece of contextual thing mm-hmm. that you give your reader. It's the one thing that no one in your story knows. They do not know what the story is called. You do. And so I was set up for a cycle, but I'm curious to ask, what do you think is required to make something parallel? Like, how yeah. many things need to work in sync for it to feel like a parallel structure for you?
Yeah, I think it's maybe almost more narrative rhyming than parallel exactly, right? Mm. Because I think you're right that it is cycles, especially in this book, right? So much of what N.K. Jemisin is trying to get across is the way cycles of violence and abuse perpetuate themselves, the way, you know, cycles of exploitation perpetuate themselves, the way cycles of seasons, you know, all of that. So to me, I think it is rhyming of certain things, right? Like, it's hard for me not to connect Shafa and Demaya, you know, in some of those early scenes with Cyanite and Alabaster going to the node maintainer, right? As we see two endpoints of the same logic, as we see two aspects of the absolute horror of what the Guardians are, right? And then I think there's also later rhymings of, you know, seeing the Guardian die when Demaya goes and finds the socket versus, you know, I think the later scenes of we see of the Guardians, both the truly horrifying attack on Alabaster when they're in the city where the coastal calm, and then sort of seeing them again at the end of the book. There's sort of this thing of like, what the hell is going on with the Guardians is like such a big question, right? And so, like, I think those rhyming things really do kind of set up that parallel. I don't think you need parallel arcs. Like, I don't think every beat needs to be the same, but I think having points here and there that echo each other, that have overlapping imagery, that have overlapping emotional states, I think all three of those can be ways in which you can create a parallel.
I talked about this in the class I taught using Beethoven's Fifth and some other musical pieces, just talking about parallels and how you don't need much. If you put a knife in someone's hand in two different scenes in the book, they are completely different people. They are completely different knives. The reader will create a parallel out of that for you. And that's an extremely useful tool. It's just realizing that one sentence, one bit of imagery, one element of a paragraph on a page can be enough to forge a parallelism in the reader's mind. And once you've done that, you can play all kinds of games.
Yeah, it's drawing the connection between two dots. And once you have that connection established, then they will feel on parallel tracks or on, you know, similar cycles to, I think, play with as a writer, you know?
Yeah, I love the concept of narrative rhyming that you just dropped in here, which I don't know if you, like, I know what you mean by it, but it might be good to sort of talk about what you mean when you talk about narrative rhyming.
Yeah, I mean, I think narrative and visual rhyming is like one of the most important techniques in all of storytelling, right? And it is to, I'm trying to find a way to describe it that isn't just relying on other metaphors, right? Like, to me, it's like a leitmotif, right, in music. Mm. It is a thing you return to over and over again, and as you do so, you can layer on more meaning to it, right? And so, like, a very simple example is the way stone lore works in the book, right? Where stone lore is referenced in all these different moments in the book, and every time we get a new piece of stone lore, or someone telling us the lore of the stone lore, so this is Alabaster explaining the secret tablets and things like that, or the you know, apocryphal texts and things like that, we're getting all those extra layers, and that adds richness and texture to our understanding of it, right? So that's like a very simple form of that rhyming, right? Another example is the moments in which parents understand that their child is an origine, right? Like that they have that power and the ways in which they respond to it, right? Because we have that both with Demaya being stuck in the barn, pig pen, whatever it is. And then, of course, we have Esun's husband literally killing one of the children and then leaving. And then we have the other parallel on the island of how they treat origine children, right? So we have this rhyming, and each time we see a new one, it's a different layer, different kind of hostility, different learnings about what the world is.
Yeah.
I think of, and when you say narrative rhyming, my mind immediately goes to The Bells by Edgar Allan Poe, because the word bell is used over and over and over again, and technically it's not a rhyme because it's the same word. Of course it rhymes with itself, but it is a concept. And parallel to it, or sitting alongside it, is the types of metals.
Yeah.
You know, iron and silver and gold and brass are all part of a narrative rhyme because they are all a metal and they are categorizing what we are getting from the bells.
Yeah.
And I like distilling it down to something tiny like a poem that's super effective because it extrapolates out big for me more easily.
It rhyming creates a pattern which creates tension because then you can resolve the pattern in one way or another. And while we are back on patterns for a moment, let's fulfill our pattern and take a break.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com. This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
Eden Royce is one of my favorite short story writers ever. I had the pleasure of editing an issue of Strange Horizons that featured her story, Every Goodbye Ain't Gone, which, like, just from the title, right, you're there. And it joins another story of hers, the Shirley Jackson-nominated Room and Board Included Demonology Extra, and 17 other short stories in her new collection, Who Lost, I Found. So Eden is an amazing Black Gothic horror writer from South Carolina, and she brings Geechee Gullah culture, which is the culture of the Sea Islands and coastal areas of the Carolinas and Georgia, into all of her work and all of her stories. And they're written in ways that make you tense, but also make you feel filled with love. So please check out the amazing Eden Royce's stories in Who Lost, I Found.
So we talked a bit about sort of the narrative rhyming and the parallel structures, the cycles. You know, one thing that I think is super interesting is, I kind of mentioned this at the beginning, but it starts with a truly awful moment and ends with a truly awful moment. And those are paired in a certain way. And there's sort of an inflection point in the middle that we get to somewhere that creates sort of this inversion by the end of the book. And I'm wondering, you know, if people have thoughts about like how that structure works from sort of end to end rather than layered.
I think one of the things that you can do is introduce surprising elements like, hello, everyone. And for me, the thing that was interesting about that was that they hit that beat of a parent killing a child more than once.
Mm.
There's a point in the middle of the book, which sets up, you know, besides the beginning, setting it up. There's a point in the middle of the book where she says that in the one of the Cyanites sections, where she says that she would later understand why sometimes killing them was more was kinder than sending them to a node outpost.
Yeah.
Mm. And when you hit that first arrival at the node outpost, you're like, oh, okay. And then when you get to the moment where she kills her own son at the very end, you also realize, for me, there were two things about that. One is that predates the killing at the beginning.
Yeah.
And it is only, what it does is it recontextualizes our understanding of why that death, the many, many layers of why that death was so horrible for her.
Yeah. I love a reveal or a twist that echoes back through the narrative you experienced mm-hmm. before and rewrites your understanding of all of those beats up until that moment.
And this, per the episode that we just had, where we were talking about whose perspective is it anyway? Mm-hmm. Why do you break up a timeline and tell a story in media res so that you can align emotional arcs differently? The emotional arcs aligned via this parallelism, via this inversion, are so much more powerful when you discover that the killing of a child that happened first, when you learn about it, and so it now reinforms your whole understanding of the thing that we opened the book with.
I keep thinking about like earthquakes and epicenters mm-hmm. and sort of mm-hmm. as its own thematic element. You know, I'm thinking about this book, and I was thinking about Ring Shout and how I would summarize them like in a word or two. And to me, like Ring Shout is about the power of community, and Fifth Season is about breaking the world.
Yeah.
And I love that in some ways this is like a seismologist, like going back and finding where the actual break was. Where was the worst break? It's the one that we end with. Yeah. Even though we start with the worst on paper, like for the world break, we end with the worst emotional break. And like, we've been sort of tracking back to it the whole time.
It's the reveal that Stone Lore is wrong. You don't look to the center. It's not just the center. It's the epicenter can be somewhere other than a perfect circle, right? Mm. And so the elliptical nature of these two points that create this sort of ovoid space of the novel, right? I don't know. There's something about that that's really powerful.
Yeah, there's a line in the book where she says, "This is what you must remember. The ending of one story is just the beginning of another."
Oof, yeah, right. And, I'm so mad at her sometimes.
yeah, very much so. Very, very much so. And one of the things that I love about the way she is using the inversion and the parallelism is that she's, sometimes people call this foreshadowing, where you set something up. Mm-hmm. And that's not exactly what the way N.K. Jemisin is wielding this. Because it's like, yes, something bad is going to happen later. But it is the recontextualization of that first element because of the bad thing that happens later. Mm-hmm. So it's not just foreshadowing. It's that thing that is a foreshadowing becomes recontextualized yeah. because of the thing that happens later. Yeah. And that's inversion, the parallelism, that's the power of that.
Yeah.
So also just FYI readers, you should read this book twice because when you read it a second time, there are layers upon layers of this kind of thing that are happening all the way through it.
Exactly. I mean, you know, I think what we were talking about in terms of it rewriting itself by the end of it and being able to see all those tricks up front, it's just an absolute masterclass. And on a craft perspective, you will just learn so much about structure, about rhyming, about all these different things if you just go back through the text a second time.
Yeah.
That actually brings me to a question, which is, let's say I'm writing something and I'm, you know, not N.K. Jemisin, which I am not. Like, how do I then, you know, figure out how to create this kind of like layered parallelism in a story? How do I rhyme narratively?
Some of the techniques that I have been playing with, because I have the same question, much of it arising after reading this book the first time. But one of the things that I've been playing with is thinking about it when you go into the book about a question that you want to ask. So she's not, like, rather than saying, I am going to tell a story about, you say, how does this affect? What are the ways, how does a parent feel when they have to kill a child? And then you ask that question.
What a question to ask.
Right? Yes. Okay. True. But then you ask that question again and again, and that allows you to set it up. Like, what does it mean for a world to end? How do we define world? Is it a personal world? Is it a larger world? Mm-hmm. And that's a question that she's asking over and over again. What does it mean to end a world? What does it mean to start again? And she doesn't do that much starting. Like we see the after effects of the world ending. We see a little bit of the starting again for the cyanide version of her, but there's a lot of endings that happen over and over again.
I mean, we see Essun starting again. It's just, there's a middle part of the start again that we don't see, right, of her life in the calm, but we do see her have to start again with the knowledge that her husband killed her son. In how do we survive this season? Right?
I guess that I feel like that is all part of the ending. I feel like that is still part of her ripping apart.
Endings are beginnings,
right?
You know?
Fair.
when you said foreshadowing, but not really foreshadowing, I had a bit of an epiphany that I'm now going to go ahead and share. The etymology of foreshadowing is the idea that something is coming toward you, and it's backlit, and so its shadow arrives first. Mm-hmm. And then I immediately went to Plato's cave, the idea that the shadow is not the thing, and the idea that some of these parallelisms are foreshadowing because you are being told the shape of the thing, but not the thing, in advance of the thing arriving, so that when it arrives, mm-hmm. you realize, I was staring at it the whole time, yeah. but the light was coming from a different angle, and so I didn't recognize it.
This is the power of the rhyming, and this is the power of the perspectives, is every time you see the thing, you're seeing it from a different angle. So from that parallax, you begin to understand more and more the true shape of the thing, or the consequences, or the context. And so that repetition is adding more and more power to your encounters with the object.
I also think thinking of circling around an object is really interesting, because one of the things that I really like is, we talked earlier about how you're like, why would someone break the world? And at the end, you're like, why wouldn't they? You know, and there is, you know, there's something really interesting there in that looking at the exact same action and being able to see it from all sides.
Yeah.
So that the thing that is both horrible and necessary is the same action. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's something really powerful in that.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. And to get back to your question, Aaron, about how you do that, one of the things that I want to also flag for readers is that, as brilliant as this book is and as brilliant as Nora is, this did not spring out of her head in this form. You have to do revisions. And that's the other way you can get this kind of parallelism and these inversions, is during the revision process.
Yes.
So don't feel like, setting yourself up with, I'm going to be thinking about these things. You can do that, but a lot of that's going to come as you layer it through the revision process.
I was literally last week working on this with an author, actually, where, you know, we are breaking it back down to the outline and looking at each of the character arcs, figuring out what needs to be here, what doesn't. And then also, how do we enhance the parallelism of those arcs? How do we line up certain beats? And, you know, really taking things from Act 5, putting them in Act 1, taking things from Act 2, putting them at the end. Mm-hmm. You know, like, so much moving around and restructuring so that we can get that rhyming repetition, you know, rhythm going through the book that will build to a conclusion. And so on that note, I have a little bit of homework for you that kind of builds on what Mary Robin and I and Aaron were all just talking about here, in terms of how to do this, right? So what I want you to do is to take a look at one of your main characters' arcs, and then try to rework another character's arc to match similar beats and structure to the first one. This can be a villain POV, this can be a love interest, this can be a traveling companion, but see if you can take the arc of one and then have that rhyming structure in the second arc, and see what that adds to the overall emotional state of the book.
This has been Writing Excuses. You're out of excuses, now go write.
Have you ever wanted to ask one of the Writing Excuses hosts for very specific, very you-focused help? There's an offering on the Writing Excuses Patreon that will let you do exactly that. The private instruction tier includes everything from the lower tiers, plus a quarterly one-on-one Zoom meeting with a host of your choice. You might choose, for example, to work with me on your humorous prose, engage Dong Wan's expertise on your world-building, or study with Aaron to level up your game writing. Visit patreon.com/writingexcuses for more details.
Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. For this episode, your hosts were Mary Robinette Kowal, Dongwon Song, Aaron Roberts, and Howard Taylor. This episode was engineered by Marshall Carr Jr., mastered by Alex Jackson, and produced by Emma Reynolds. For more information, visit writingexcuses.com.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue 1 last year.
I know, by a wide margin too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the Reproductive Rights Amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.